Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
When natural disasters strike, they can impact just about every aspect of life. The ultimate cost of such disasters is actually a science of its own, and no one is more familiar with those costs than those charged with ensuring all that is important to us. Today, we'll talk with Steve Bowen, Director of Meteorology at AON, to look back at the weather-related disasters of 2018. Plus, fascinating conversation that will explain how Mr. Bowen utilizes analytics to help communicate and prepare the world for the risk associated with a future that promises to bring more and more extreme weather. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. And Steve, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And we were just talking beforehand about your role there at AON, which I think used to be branded as AON Benfield, but you're now AON. Tell us a little bit about who you are, Steve, and what you do.
Sure. So my background is in meteorology. I got my bachelor's in meteorology from Florida State University.
Go Noles.
Yes. And after that time, I went back to school and I got my master's in business analytics from the University of Notre Dame, which may not elicit similar excitement, Dr. Shepard. I actually, coming out of Florida State, I initially started in television. I worked in Tallahassee while I was in school, and then I was hired into Tampa afterwards. So I was there for the 2004-2005 hurricane seasons. And then after a couple of years in television, I decided to shift gears a bit. I'm originally from the Midwest, and I had always looked to get back towards to Chicago, and I found an opportunity to work for AON here in Chicago. So I've been here now for almost 12 years, and my current role, I head the Catastrophe Insight team, which does a lot of real-time and historical natural disaster analysis, trying to help clients identify, weather trends, climate trends, any type of natural peril trends to help our clients get a better understanding of the risks that they may face. And a lot of that has to do with a financial component, not just the insured loss, but also the overall economic toll, which are very important pieces of the puzzle when you're trying to help people get a better understanding as to what is happening. Because obviously the science is very important, but when you're talking about this to the everyday layman, I like to use a term called Fisher pricing the science, or Fisher pricing certain aspects
I love it.
Of information, basically, to make it easily digestible for everybody. And so a big part of my role is doing the analysis from a higher level scientific point of view, but also turning around and explaining it to our clients, because as we know, the people that are at the most risk, they oftentimes don't realize it. So you have to be very clear and precise in what the risks they're facing. So if you do face disaster, that they're not completely caught off guard.
Yes. And we're going to talk about the 2018 mega weather disasters. That's really the topic of this podcast today. But I really want to linger here for just a moment, because I think you're working in an area where perhaps many people that go into weather or meteorology may not think about. And it sounds like this was not something perhaps on your radar screen, pun intended, when you were a student of meteorology at our mutual alma mater.
No, and to be honest, I was completely surprised when I was doing some role searching, 10, 11, 12 years ago, and I saw insurance, and I sort of scratched my head at first, but then when you start looking into it, it makes complete sense, just because from an insurance point of view, there's just so much of what insurance deals with happens to be with weather and natural peril. So, it really is a natural fit. And what we're seeing, not just with insurance, but in the private sector, is a much more important role for not just meteorologists, but science and scientists in general, hydrologists, geologists, seismologists, wind engineers, all types of different engineers. are being hired by energy groups. They're being hired by even sports teams, hire meteorologists, you know, just to, you know, ensure that everyone has a good understanding as to what's going on. And I think that, you know, as you know, from a data perspective, we continue to see data availability become much more robust, and it's much you know, the quality is much better. I think that, you know, we're trying to turn to people that can interpret what some of this data means and make some better decisions.
Yeah, and it just sort of illustrates how weather literally touches almost every aspect of our daily lives, from transportation to the gross domestic product to insurance to the food we eat, et cetera. And so I think this is a good time to think about the 2018 disasters. But before I go there, the one more question, what process do you use to access or assess damage potential prior to a Florence or a Hurricane Michael or a wildfire? Is there some process in your industry that you go through?
Well, there's a lot of different things. I mean, we could probably go on it for hours if we really wanted to get deep into the weeds. But
give us the Fisher Price version.
Yeah, the Fisher Price version. So, I mean, in AON, one of the main tools that we use is called catastrophe modeling, which is essentially different types of computer simulations for different disaster types. And you can take an insurance portfolio and you can run different types of scenarios, either a, you know, a historical event that has happened, or what we call a stochastic event, which is essentially a hypothetical scenario, and run it through these models, and it comes out with an output. You can get an event footprint, you know, where the wind speeds may be highest. You could get a flood, inland flood component or a storm surge component. And when you overlay insurance portfolios, then you get a better understanding as to, you know, where the highest risk could be and where the highest loss could be. And then we take that information and we can turn around and hand that over to insurance companies who are our clients or brokers, and then they have a better understanding to be able to communicate in turn to their clients to have a better understanding of the types of risks they face with the different types of scenarios that we may model.
Yes. So, yeah, there's clearly a process here, and it really all circles back to the weather, which is where I want to transition now. 2018, give me your thoughts before we talk about the specific events. Give me your overarching thoughts on 2018 from a weather disasters perspective. How would you sort of summarize 2018 relative to recent years or perhaps even past years?
You know, if you asked me this question 6 months ago, I would have said, you know, this is looking like it's going to be a pretty boring year. I mean, the year started off pretty benign, but once we hit the third quarter, things just really started to ramp up. You know, and not just the U.S. I mean, typically on an insurance side, the U.S. Tends to dominate the losses, is because the insurance market in the U.S. is, you know, very, very mature. And so there's much more of a presence here than, say, Asia Pacific or Latin America, where these emerging markets, the insurance industry has yet to make a full, play there yet. You know, 2018 has been very active, not just for the U.S., but also for areas like Japan, which has seen, you know, numerous very strong typhoon events and flooding events, which has been very costly for the industry there. So, you know, I would say on a whole, coming out of 2017, 2018 was not quite as hectic as last year was, but 2018 is definitely going to go down as one of the more expensive years from a financial point of view from a lot of these disasters.
And let's use that opportunity to now talk about some of the specific disasters that we saw. Let's start with Hurricane Florence, because I think that's around that time frame where things started ramping up from perhaps what seemed to be a boring year, relatively speaking. Clearly, there's certainly things going on throughout the year that impact people, but I get your point about boring from the standpoint of not being a mega anomaly year, but certainly things started to change with Hurricane Florence.
If I can interject really quickly about that, because I think there's an interesting point in all this. So just how the perception has changed. So this year was really been considered a down year for U.S. severe convective storm, for thunderstorm events. Yes. But the total aggregate losses are still in excess of $10 billion, even on the insurance side.
$10 billion with a B is what you said. I want to make sure the listeners heard that, not million, billion.
Correct.
Yes.
$10 billion. And this is primarily driven by hail. And, you know, I think most of the time, most people assume costly years or active years just entirely based on the frequency of tornadoes, when in reality is that what's really driving the cost tends to be hail and severe straight line winds. And those pictures typically aren't as sexy as, you know, the storm chasers going out and seeing the tornadoes. But the reality is this was considered to be a down year, but this was actually the 11th consecutive year where we've seen SES losses in excess of $10 billion. Which is really staggering, because when we were back in 2008, 2009, when we first sort of hit that threshold, people were, you know, sort of freaking out because we hadn't seen losses at that level. But they've maintained a consistent, you know, elevated stretch over the course of more than a decade now. So, you know, it's interesting just from a perception view how, you know, now it was considered a down year, even though the losses still were, fairly significant.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting? And I can, by the way, attest to the whole hail impact. My family was caught in a fairly significant hailstorm here in Georgia earlier in the year. We had golf ball to tennis ball size hailstones, and there's even a video floating around out there if you search on of me and my family in the car, my wife videoing as these large hailstones are pounding our car, dented our car. Many homes within our subdivision had roof damage, so we can certainly attest to exactly what you were just talking about. The other point I would add to what you just said, it always is typically the non-telegenic, somewhat boring aspects of extremes that often can be the most dangerous. I think about what kills people most in the U.S. each year weather-wise. It's heat, and it's not telegenic. It's not winds blowing around and hurricanes pounding into the coastlines, but it's deadly. So I can really resonate with the point you just made. I want to kind of shift now to Florence. What do you think was most unusual about Florence compared to other hurricanes from your perspective?
Well, you know, it has to be the rainfall and the inland flood component. And what was, you know, truly concerning about this when it echoed Harvey from an insurance standpoint is that there was such low national flood insurance program policy take-up in the Carolinas, which, you know, to bring it down, to simplify a little bit, essentially in your typical homeowner's policy, flood is not covered. So you have to buy a separate policy through the federal government called the National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP. And you know, a lot of people, less than 1% in some of these inland counties in the Carolinas, just did not have policies in place. And because of that, that meant, similar to Harvey last year, that a high portion of the overall damage that was incurred was not actually covered by insurance because those you know, take-up rates were so low. So to me, one of the big concerns, you know, again, not trying to compare Harvey and Florence, they were different events entirely, but just from the overall theme of the excessive rainfall and the overall impact that was about to occur, you know, it was definitely concerning, you know, wondering just how much of that protection gap was going to be exposed. And, you know, based on some of the initial bits of data and information that we've gotten, it still looks like, you know, less than a third of the overall cost is probably going to be covered by insurance, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a great point to sort of get out there for those listening to the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm talking with Steve Bowen, Director of Meteorology at EON. And we're talking about Hurricane Florence, and I'm curious, in the world that you operate in, are you sensitive at all to how good or bad the track and intensity forecasting are, or does none of that essentially matter for the types of work you do?
Oh, on the contrary, it's huge. You know, in our business, even one slight track deviation can be the difference in billions of dollars worth of damage. I mean, you know, I don't want to say famously, but I had tweeted out something around Hurricane Matthew a couple of years ago where I called it the billion-dollar wobble, because as Matthew was coming up, it looked like it was headed towards the east coast of Florida, and it did this slight wobble back to the northeast. which kept the core of the storm offshore, you know, north of Miami, and that truly saved literally billions of dollars of the damage. So, you know, we are very, very, you know, laser focused on the track and intensity, just because we know that these little shifts can make a huge difference in hitting, you know, a max population exposure center versus a more rural area. So, you know, we're very, very focused, and that's why things such as, you know, IWOW replacement cycles, you know, because we're talking about the expansion of the wind field and things like that, that plays a really big role on what the potential impact is. So, you know, most people think insurers are just sort of, you know, waiting around and wanting to get in there after the event to process claims. But, you know, part of that process of getting people put in place post-event is, you know, studying the storm, the cycles, the intensities, and looking at all the different models to try to get a good sense as to where these events might go. So, yeah, it's all tied together. So, you know, those slight tracks can mean the difference of many billions of dollars.
Yeah, and as we saw, interestingly with Florence, people were really initially focused on, oh, this is a Cat 4 barreling towards North Carolina. And then it was reduced to a Cat 2 level storm or so. And I think for some people, the guard was let down a little bit. But many of us, like you and I in this field, knew that the rain and the fact that this storm was going to stall was going to be the main problem.
Yeah, and that goes back to a much larger problem that I wish, you know, you and I could sit here and solve that problem, but that's unfortunately probably not going to happen. But, you know, just trying to communicate the uncertainty and, you know, everything that comes into it, because I think there's still a, you know, unfortunately, everyone looks at the, you know, the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale and they just assume, okay, you know, it was a 4 and now it's a 2 or a 1 and it means that my risk is going down, but they don't see the full picture. They don't understand the uncertainty that if the storm slows down and it's tapping into a, you know, a really rich pool of moisture, that you could be talking about, you know, substantial rainfall totals and inland flooding. So, you know, there's going to have to be something done. You know, it's going to take everybody essentially to sit down and, you know, try to come up with some type of communication, you know, adaptability to be able to explain to people, to tell them that, you know, the Saffir-Simpson scale wind speed, you know, projection is just one small component to a much larger threat that, you know, tropical cyclones end up posing.
Yeah, well, Weather Geeks listeners, if after you're finished with this podcast with Steve Bowen, go back into the Weather Geeks archive, wherever you listen to the podcast, and check out the podcast I did with former director of the National Hurricane Center, Rick Knapp, because we talked about that very issue, and it's certainly one that's still ever present as we move forward. And I want to use that as a transition to Hurricane Michael, which in some ways was the more traditional hurricane threat that I think people think about. Got a strong hurricane moving to a part of the country that hadn't seen a storm that strong. But interestingly enough, it didn't initially look to be that strong and went through what we call a rapid intensification cycle and ended up being a Cat 4-ish level, maybe weak Cat 5 if it gets reclassified later, storm. What made Michael so different or special or interesting from your perspective, Steve?
Well, I did a post-event survey down there about a month ago, and I'll say that the level of devastation there was, you know, especially on the storm surge side, was you know, heartbreaking and very intense. I, you know, in my line of work, I tend to do a lot of post-event surveys, and, you know, Michael is one that certainly, you know, is going to stick with me for a long time. But, you know, I think what was most concerning, you know, to a lot of us is that the part of Florida that Michael hit, you know, it's you know, locally it's called the Forgotten Coast, meaning that a lot of the homes and the construction that's there, you know, is of an older building type, and so a lot of these structures haven't been retrofitted to meet the, you know, the current building code standards that are in place. You know, and as we sat there and we watched, you know, Michael undergoing this, you know, explosive rapid intensification, there was, you know, definitely a lot of concern as to whether or not these older structures were going to be able to withstand. And, you know, doing the on-the-ground survey, I think that, you know, rightly most of the focus was, you know, on Mexico Beach and some of the areas directly, you know, around landfall in Tyndall Air Force Base. But the scope of partial damage in Panama City was really surprising. I mean, I would say, you know, at least the majority of every building in Panama City or Panama City Beach had some type of damage, from the wind, not just from a water perspective. So, Michael was, definitely surprising because, the initial forecast that came out from the NHC, it didn't show that level of strengthening. So it caught a lot of us off guard, but I think, for us in the insurance industry, we were even more concerned that it was hitting a particularly vulnerable part of the state in which building codes may not be quite as stringent as they are in the southern part of Florida and the peninsula, and especially with an older building stock where we know that, there's some retirees, there's people that have vacation homes there that they may not have, had their homes built to, the current code.
Yeah, that was actually something that concerned me as well, as someone that also spent time in that region.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard, and I'm talking with Steve Bowen, Director of Meteorology at AON, talking about the weather disasters of 2018. And we're still talking about Michael. One other really interesting aspect of Michael was the fact that it did end up being so strong. And because it was so strong and moving at a pretty good clip, it maintained its intensity well inland in the parts of the panhandle of Florida, even parts of Georgia, really destroyed much of the cotton, pecan, and peanut crop there in Georgia. Was that something that you expected, and do you worry that we will see more of that type of inland maintenance of intensity?
I'll be honest, as shocked as I was at the damage along the coast near the landfall location, we actually drove all the way into southwest Georgia, to do the damage survey, and we found that there was that one site that had 120 mile per hour wind gust, and we actually visited that location, and the damage that we saw there was matching that Cat 3 type of wind damage that you would expect. And that was really shocking. The fact that the storm maintained its intensity so far inland was, really surprising. I'm almost left speechless. I don't know what to say, just because it's not something that you typically, expect a hurricane to maintain that level of strength that far inland, especially that far amount of time. I don't have a good answer for that, but it's something that, it catches us off guard. And I think that's, one of the important points about the weather, especially for me, is that the weather continues to humble me. I always feel like I have a pretty good grasp on how things go. Obviously, I don't know everything, no one does, but, there are still some events that surprise me and force me to kind of go back and relook at the literature. Just trying to figure out what actually happened. I know that you've done some great work on things like the brown ocean effect, inland. Maybe it was, feeding off of, wet soils or something like that kind of kept it going that far inland. But, I'm still kind of at a loss as to what, kept its intensity that far inland.
Yeah, no, it was, we thought a little bit about perhaps whether it was a brown ocean case. I don't think this one was. Interestingly enough, in that part of Georgia, there are a lot of irrigation, center pivot irrigation, which can provide moisture, but it really wasn't the peak of the irrigation season. So it's one that's sort of baffling to us as well. But I know I went down to the Florida State College football game a couple of weeks ago, and I was just stunned as I drove down from Albany to Tallahassee, just looking at all the pecan trees down. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's one component of these big catastrophe events that often gets overlooked, and that's the agricultural component. And we're talking expected ag losses from Michael, approaching $5 billion, and that also includes impacts to forestry. And the time of year that Michael hit, they were getting ready to harvest peak season, and all that stuff was highly exposed and at risk. And it took a beating. It's going to take a while, especially for the pecan trees to grow back.
Yeah, absolutely. Now let's shift over to the West Coast, because they've had their own record in destructive weather and weather related events as well with the wildfires. I mean, we had destructive wildfires, the Camp Fire, and fires down near Southern California as well. What was it about these fires that made them so destructive?
Well, I'll say right off the bat that, the last 2 years of wildfire damage that we've seen in California has essentially been off the charts. I mean, from a loss perspective, it's really been striking as to how much devastation that has occurred. What's been particularly, heartbreaking to see is that we've had a major conflagration that essentially wiped out an entire city. And that's not something that, we would typically expect to occur in, the 21st century and, our ability to, forecast and try to get a better sense as to, what might happen. But, I don't think anybody, would have assumed that a fairly, noteworthy city would have almost burned to the ground. So, that was very, very shocking. But I also think that it opens the door for a much, more important conversation and dialogue that needs to happen about people that are unfortunately moving into some of these known fire locations that are, have long been identified as areas of risk for fire. And the fact that these fires are still occurring, and then when you add the climate change component and, the evolution of extreme weather and, the fire behavior and things like that and the expansion of the season, it's quite concerning that there's just way more people in these areas that, tend to be at risk. And so the big question is, what do we do going forward from a mitigation perspective? And a lot of that, is going to start with simple education, but, there's probably going to have to be some tough decisions on what we're going to do to ensure that, we don't continue to have these types of losses in the future.
Yeah, and I was going to actually ask you about that because I wrote something in Forbes about this sort of urban wildland interface, which is a what I believe the terminology is called, at least the U.S. Forest Service, in this notion that there are more people and buildings and things and places where it used to burn. And frankly, some of the burning in the natural ecosystems is required sort of for maintenance of the ecosystem. But now there's suppression of those natural burning cycles because people and houses and things are there now, and we don't want to put those at risk. So it really is an interesting sort of dilemma that we find ourselves in, right?
Yeah, and what was unique about Paradise is that it wasn't the interface, it was the intermix, which is a slightly different terminology. The interface is sort of the immediate divide between areas we expect to burn and areas that typically aren't expected to burn. But the intermix means areas that are sort of embedded within a much more forested area, and that's unfortunately where Paradise was. So it was even more, vulnerable, to fire. But, the fire suppression issue is a hot button topic, as we know, just from, some of the conversation that's been going on in the public space. Something is likely going to have to evolve. And a lot of that comes down to the funding and budgeting and, firefighters, being exhausted. I think if you talk to a lot of the firefighters and you read some of the accounts, is that a lot of these guys are just exhausted. They're fighting these massive fires almost on a year round basis now, and it's really changing the perception, the view as to how we actually handle and tolerate these types of events.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm talking with Steve Bowen, Director of Meteorology at AON, and we're taking a look back at the 2018 season of weather and the weather disasters. We've talked about Hurricane Michael, we've talked about the wildfires in Florence, and one of the things that you said there in the last segment, particularly as it relates to the California wildfires, you seem to suggest that the wildfire season is year-round. Is this indicative of a sign of, and I don't even like to say a sign of things to come, because I think we're there. I think we're just going to continue this and perhaps accelerate it. But is this a sign of things to come because of a shifting climate? I mean, the wildfires is a really challenge. I mean, I served on a National Academy study that looked at this concept of attribution. Can we attribute current events, weather disasters and events, to a climate change signal? And some things are a bit more clear cut in that study than others, things like heat waves, extreme rainfall. Wildfires was a challenge because, though there are certainly some things that are linked to weather and climate, there are other things that you just talked about that are also at play. So what are your thoughts on this? Is it a sign of things to come or to continue?
Well, you can't look and say 2 years is defining a trend. I mean, that's a bit too tough to say from a loss perspective, but from the overall risk perspective, I think that it's given some of the points that I made previously about the continued growth of exposure into areas that are particularly prone to fires. But, you know, when we're talking about the climate change influence, you know, the changes in extreme weather variability, you know, wildfire is challenging because if you do have a year like we had a couple of years ago, which we had, you know, very high levels of precipitation, you know, the water year was near record levels, and that allowed for, you know, fairly significant vegetative growth. And what's concerning, and this is where the climate change component comes in, if you're seeing these very massive and quick shifts from, you know, heavy precipitation to extreme drought, you know, from a wildfire perspective, you know, when all that brand new vegetation dries out and dies, it basically sits there and it acts as, abundant fuel that's waiting to go up in flame. So, you know, it's really concerning. And when you have these really extreme shifts, that just, you know, really complicates, you know, how you're gonna deal with it in terms of cleanup and just, you know, doing the fire suppression and the controlled burns. You know, it really does add another level of complexity to an already pretty challenging topic.
Yeah, and I think this is right, but it just points also to the complexity geophysically in terms of the science, but also the societal sort of interfaces and interactions as well.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
We're talking about billion-dollar disasters, weather disasters that we've seen in 2018, many people may be surprised to find that there is a snowstorm listed on that this year. How does a winter storm become a billion-dollar disaster?
Yeah, so that was we had a couple of pretty large nor'easters back in the first quarter of the year, January, February, March, and winter storms are definitely unique. You know, they can certainly snarl traffic, you know, travel, you know, the airports, as everyone knows, you get one delay in O'Hare or New York and everything, the whole country shuts down. But you can get, quite a bit of damage from winter storms from excessive accumulation of snow on roofs. You know, you combine that with ice and that can cause, you know, a roof collapse. Most of the damage, you know, from a physical damage perspective actually comes from fallen tree branches and trees onto cars and homes and businesses, you know, broken windows. That it may not be total devastation that you would see from, say, a tornado or from a hurricane. But if you have a lot of different properties that have been damaged, you know, partially, all those little, you know, payouts and things, that all adds up fairly quickly. So that's where you typically will see, claims and damage adding up pretty quickly. And then also you have the automobile component. You get a lot of traffic accidents. And that's why, you know, in many cases you tend to see, you know, so many road closures, just because, you know, highway patrol men are very concerned about, you know, black ice and things on the roads that may lead to, you know, even greater risk on the roadway. So there's a lot of different factors. It's not as cut and dry as some of the other, other perils, but, you can definitely get some pretty expensive events.
Yeah, no, I'm curious, you talked about the snowstorms, and certainly I understand what you said there. Are there any other types of cold weather related events that end up sort of impacting sort of insurance or insurance claims or whatnot, or is it really just the big storms?
Well, it's the big storms, but then, a couple of years ago when, you know, the polar vortex was sort of the term of the day.
The buzzword of the day, and it's not an Arctic hurricane.
Right, exactly. You know, and when you get these prolonged cold snaps, and that's when you have to focus on things such as, pipes freezing and bursting, and then you get a lot of, basically water damage inside the home just because pipes are bursting. So, you know, you can get these after event effects. It's typically after nor'easters, that's when it's pulling down, you know, the tremendous, pool of cold air. A lot of times people just assume, okay, well, the storm is done, you know, my risk of possible impact goes away. And that's not true. If you get a really extended period of time with very cold temperatures, you know, if you're not, you know, having the water drip, I know that's sort of an old wives' tale, but that really does, you know, work. It plays a big role just to, you know, to ensure that the pipes aren't actually freezing. But that can definitely add up very quickly. You can get, losses adding up to more than a billion if you get a really widespread event that, areas that may not necessarily be as accustomed to some of these cold snaps that, other places might be.
And we're back on the Weather Geeks podcast, and I'm talking with Steve Bowen. You mentioned we've been fairly U.S.-centric in our billion-dollar disaster discussion as it relates to weather, but you mentioned earlier that there have been some global disasters of note, too. Talk about those.
Yeah, and what stands out to me the most has to be Japan. They've had multiple billion-dollar events. In fact, Typhoon Jebi is looking like, from an economic perspective, it's going to be at least a $10 billion event. It's actually for the insurance insurance industry over there. It's going to be one of the most expensive natural or typhoon events ever recorded. And then a couple of weeks after that, they had Typhoon Trami, which also is a multi-billion dollar event. And that doesn't even include the floods they had in July, which were also another multi-billion dollar event. So Japan has been very, very active this year from a typhoon standpoint. And some of that question is whether or not, with the, pending transition to El Nino and just some of the shifts and tracks that you do see with those different types of ENSO phase, that may, contribute to some of the clustering that went on this year. But Japan has definitely had a pretty tough year.
Talk about, you mentioned El Nino, and it looks as though we're shifting into an El Nino pattern, or perhaps in the earlier phases of it, perhaps intensifying even more by early 2019. How do you consider these sort of climate variability forcings like El Nino or the Arctic Oscillation and what you think about in your job?
It's really interesting. I think it's probably more, intriguing for me as a scientist as opposed to, the broker that sits next to me. But, what we can do with that information is at least, turn around and explain and say, okay, this is what we've seen in historical and, El Nino years. This is what we've seen in La Nina years. Because there tend to be shifts. Some areas will see, more in the way of flood damage. Some areas will see greater drought risk. That's really important from the agricultural side of things. But then also, like I mentioned with the, the typhoon tracks, just knowing that, with certain setups that occur with these different types of oscillations that, you may want to shift some of your focus, slightly to some of these areas. So, you're not guaranteeing that something may happen, but, looking at the past, ends up telling a pretty good story for the future. So, it's impossible to identify, exactly where things may be, but you can at least provide some overall, overhead guidance, to give people a heads up as to what might actually occur.
Yeah, great point. And I think I want to now transition the last segment of the podcast to how you utilize the data and how you communicate. How can you take your work to help communicate and prepare for future disasters? I know you're assessing and you're thinking about insurance implications and cost implications, but can you go beyond that in terms of what you do to help communicate and prepare for future risk?
Yeah, it's all about putting things into context. And I think, a lot of times these big events happen, and on social media, as you know, especially, every event people seem to think is the worst event that's ever happened. And I think that, when you have a robust data set and you have a lot of background information, you can help provide some context and you can, have a data-driven sort of perspective of things as to what's actually going on. And so when we have this level of information, we can turn around and we can explain it to our clients. We can, I work with folks in the government to help them kind of understand, everything that's going on, because we're all, it's all a give and take. There's some things that we do well in the private sector and there's things that the government does exceptionally well. So it's all a matter of working together and trying to, come up with a working platform to be able to communicate, the risks. So, what we do with the loss data is again, we take into account the increase in exposures in some areas. Then we also look at, some of the available, say, FEMA flood maps or some of the different types of mapping available that highlights risk in some of these areas. When you put all that together, you're telling a much clearer story. So when you go to the residents or if you go speak, to a city council, you have all this information. You can tell them, okay, here's where we used to be. here's where we are today, and if we see the current trends continue, this is what we could see again in the future. And you know, when you're talking about resiliency and climate resiliency and mitigation tactics, you know, all of these things are really important components.
Now, you said trends. So you are confirming, based on your work and what you see, that we are seeing increasing trends. And the reason I ask this is there are some out there who say, well, these billion-dollar numbers and the increasing costs that we're seeing, it's because there's more stuff that costs more in the pathway or being destroyed by many of these weather events. And there's some truth to that. But from your perspective, do you see an increasing trend in the extreme weather events themselves?
Yeah, and it's funny you mention that, because there really is there's essentially three different types of data that people, you know, that have available to them. So you have the nominal cost, which means the losses that actually occurred at the time of occurrence, and then you have the inflation adjusted numbers, which is essentially taking the loss from when it occurred and then you're using inflation adjustment to today's dollars, and then there's this normalization a data set which is floating around, which is also very important, but that's essentially a hypothetical. So that's not losses that have actually occurred. That's essentially taking the loss, the nominal loss, and then trying to incorporate today's current exposure and try to essentially guesstimate what the hypothetical loss could be if certain scenarios occurred today. So if you're looking at it purely from a historical loss perspective and inflation adjustment numbers, I mean, it's been very, very noticeable. The trend is obvious that the losses are definitely going up. And that's the data set that you see from NOAA, you know, with the billion-dollar events data set that they have there. That's all based on the actual loss that occurred and trending it to today's dollars. And there's a very, very discernible trend. Yeah. So where things do start to adjust is when you start to normalize. And you're trying to essentially take these, you know, historical events, say the 1900, you know, Galveston hurricane, for instance, and you're trying to, you know, guesstimate what that loss would be today if that same scenario occurred. So it's really tough. It's a great data point. It's great to be able to have that data set and try to determine, you know, are we truly seeing shifts in, increased damage costs or decreased damage costs if we sort of replicated these historical events to today. And, you know, right now there's not a statistically significant, you know, indicator that shows that losses are actually going up. But when you're looking purely at the actual losses that have occurred, they absolutely are going up. I mean, the number of billion-dollar events that are occurring in real time, you know, continue to go up in frequency. And given, you know, the continued increase in exposure and stuff just costs more today, you know, we expect to see more of that in the future. So it's sort of a long-winded answer. I apologize for that. But, you know, there's just a lot of different ways of looking at it. And I think that some folks just want to, you know, get in their corner and, you know, grab onto something that fits their own sort of narrative. But it's a bit more, complex than that.
Well, you know, we certainly know that those narratives and misinformation and agendas are out there. But folks like you that sort of think about bottom lines and money and risk and costs have been thinking about and acknowledging the science and the data for some time. And so I think anyone that's paying attention should be aware of that, because people like you and the reinsurance industry and others have been thinking about these issues for a while. I think I want to end the podcast with one sort of positive note here. What are some simple steps that those listening can do to better prepare themselves or their families for these unexpected or perhaps predicted weather disasters?
Sure. So the best thing to do is prepare. You know, from an insurance point of view, you want to know what your policy covers. You want to know all the things that you own, because when you're a day or two away from a big event that may be occurring, things are just way too hectic. You know, you're trying to, you know, find an escape route. You're trying to ensure everyone's safety and get out of the house. And you may forget a thing or two. And if you come back and your home has unfortunately been affected, you know, you may not necessarily be able to account for everything, you know, that you may have had. So, you know, have a plan in place. You know, take pictures of your stuff, you know, take stock of the things that, you know, are most important to you, most valuable. So, you know, if you do unfortunately have the worst case happen, you'll be able to have some, you know, documentation and you can hand over and, you know, make things a bit easier in the recovery process. So, you know, it's the same thing with everything. It's about preparation. It's about, you know, ensuring, you know what to do and, you know, when things are most complicated and challenging and, you know, kind of crazy, you know, if you have a pre-plan put in place, then that'll make things certainly much easier.
I think that's excellent advice, and I've enjoyed talking with Steve Bowen, Director of Meteorology at AON. Steve, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thanks for having me.